Hi everyone, it's Kino here. Thanks so much for joining me on Seek Up, the Yoga Inspiration Show. I am so grateful for you and grateful to you for tuning in and sharing this journey with me. I am overwhelmed with how many people come up to me and say that they're really enjoying this type of communication, teaching, and sharing. So thank you so much for being a part of this journey of yoga, this journey of spirituality, this journey of mindfulness, this journey of seeking wisdom. More than anything else, this is meant to support the seeker's journey, meant to support you on the path. If you find this series of teaching really beneficial, the way that you can support this series is to become a member of the Om Stars yoga community and practice. We have decided to make this series free and available to everyone so that no matter where you are in the world, you can get the teachings that will hopefully provide sustenance for the seeker's journey. And for those of you that can become a member and give your support, please know that I appreciate it. And I'll see you on the mat real soon. So it was really nice to share the practice with all of you and really nice to share the practice in community. One of the important things about coming together and doing the practice is this feeling of community, a feeling of togetherness that we get when we do any kind of a sort of shared experience of the practice. Some of you are newer to the Ashtanga practice, and some of you are quite dedicated and have been practicing for many years. And all together, we make the community of practitioners. And one of the things that can be very challenging in the world of yoga is that sometimes our community, particularly in the Ashtanga yoga world, is spread out. Sometimes we end up feeling alone on the journey. Sometimes we end up feeling like it's just us. There's even a friend of mine who started to say it's Ashtanga against the world, which I'm not in favor of, but I understand the sentiment. You know, we're actually not against, it's more the opposite, but it's this feeling of being alone on a very difficult, demanding, and arduous path, as though you're the one who wakes up and does this practice and goes against the grain of everything that's around you. And without the feeling of community, doing that can be very difficult. If you're the only yoga person that's in your life, then it can be difficult to feel the support. When the people around you question your choices, why are you getting up so early to stretch yourself? You know, why are you doing such severe things to your body? Why does the leg need to really go there anyway? You know, and then why do you need to, you know, eat so healthfully? Why can't you just, you know, eat a turkey for the holidays or whatever it is? And so when you get those kinds of feedback from the people around you, it's difficult to feel like you're part of something that's not a solitary journey. And it takes great effort to stay on the path. So it's so good to come together in community, in what is called Sangha. And it's so important to understand the vital role that we each play in the creation and the continuation of the community of like-minded spiritual practitioners. The community of seekers is something special to be nurtured, to be cultivated, to be cherished, and to cultivate and to participate in as much as we can. One of the most important ways that we participate in the Sangha, this is the Sanskrit word for community, coming from sam, which is sameness or oneness, and the contact point. So we usually call this togetherness or coming together, uniting together, or community, a gathering. And it's this idea that the Sangha is something that we have to choose to play a vital role in, and something that we help co-create when we participate in it, when we decide, now I'm going to show up. I'm going to go to class. Each of you made a decision this morning, let me come. You know, we all had the option not to come, but each of us made a decision, I will go. I will do this practice. I will show up here. I will brave whatever obstacles are on the way, and I will do my practice. And then not only did you show up, but you completed the practice. That's something. There are some people, they show up and then they think, no, you know, halfway through, they just say, you know, I'm going to lie down. And if you have days like that, it's okay. But everybody here completed the practice. So we showed up, we completed the practice, we did the practice. This in and of itself is a contribution to the Sangha. So essentially, we support one another just by the sheer fact that we're here and we're going through it together. There's this feeling that sometimes we don't have the energy on our own. Many of you have probably tried practicing at home on your own. And then you unroll the mat and you think, well, maybe I have to go to the bathroom real quick. And then we go to the bathroom and then we come back and then we think, well, maybe I should light a candle. I don't have a lighter. Why don't I have a lighter? Oh, because I don't smoke. Oh, maybe I should buy a lighter. And then, so sometimes I really like lighting a candle. It helps me create the atmosphere of practice. I often don't have a lighter, especially when I'm traveling. And I can see that when I go into a convenience store and buy a lighter, that the people who are selling me a lighter look at me a little strange. Maybe I don't look like someone who needs a lighter. And I'm like, do you have a lighter? I'm like, okay, absolutely. So when you're doing a home practice, maybe you don't have a lighter, you decide, oh, I can't light a candle, I can't light any incense, and then maybe you start the practice, and then maybe the FedEx delivery person arrives right when you started, and they need you to sign to get some package, you know, or the phone rings, or the laundry machine goes off, life intervenes. And so when we're solitary practitioners, it requires so much effort to get the practice done. We did the full primary series today. If you think back to any of you who've tried to do that on your own, sometimes getting through primary series by yourself feels like a marathon. But today, even though it was challenging, because of the Sangha, we had energy from one another. So we carried each other through. And this is why coming together in community is so important. And why gathering points around a practice create a sense to even leave a little bit of residue with us if we need to carry that home into our own practice. If we are, you know, home practitioners primarily, whenever we join a community, then we can, and whenever we join specifically our community, then we can carry a little bit of that inspiration back to our home practice, or even back to our practice when we show up with a teacher. So this feeling of tapping into something bigger than what we have access to on our own is such an important part of staying inspired along the path. I've seen too many people think that they could do it on their own. You know, I'm good. So what? It's a series of poses. I have it memorized. I never need to go to class again. I've got it. And then a year goes by, and then all of the seeds of what will take us off the path start to be sown by the bad patterns of the mind. For example, why do we have to do so many poses? You know, doubt starts to seep in. Maybe the poses are fine, but not all that jump back business, you know? You know, so some of us, let's remove some of those jump backs. Oh, it's too extreme. Oh, maybe I should do this instead, do that instead. Maybe I should throw in a little bit of some other exercise in the middle of a primary series for entertainment, you know? And then 2 years go by, 3 years go by, and I've seen this happen to some of the most dedicated practitioners because they were practicing on their own. 5 years goes by, and then they don't practice Ashtanga yoga anymore. They practice, maybe they still practice, maybe they turn to a totally different modality. But if you don't check back in with your community, it's very easy to go astray. So we say traditionally that the community is created, co-created by the teacher and the student. That it's not only the teacher's responsibility, it's not only the solitary student's responsibility, but there's a magical intersection that comes to play when there's a teaching or a teacher, and then many students who are inspired by that, that's what creates the Sangha, that we are united by soft values that are often hard to hard to elucidate in words, hard to explain. And when we come together, we tap into some sort of a nonverbal connection. So one question that I think is very useful to consider when we think about the benefit that we get from practicing in the Sangha is, what am I doing to contribute to the Sangha? How am I contributing? Number one, by showing up. Definitely, if you don't show up, then there's no Sangha. So if nobody came today, and I've had classes where no one has shown up, especially in Miami, when we first started Miami Life Center, my husband and I would be very excited if someone showed up when we first opened. There were numerous classes where no one showed up. I even had a class that an old friend of mine from before I ever did yoga showed up to try to support my new business venture. And she really tried to do some sun salutations. But then she started to sweat profusely. And she stood up and said, I had no idea I was going to sweat. I'm really not into this. Can we go get some coffee? And she was an old friend of mine. So what could I say? I said, all right, let's go get coffee instead. You know, really, it's hard to teach your friends, you know, especially if you know them before you started being a teacher. So we ask ourselves, how am I contributing? Sometimes we put a lot of emphasis on the teacher's responsibility, right? What is the teacher doing? Is the teacher there? Is the teacher this? Is the teacher that? But we have to understand that we ourselves are, as students, are a vital part of the community, and that the creation of Sangha is not dependent on the teacher always showing up. The fact that there is a teaching that is available, that should be enough to create some kind of a spark. And then there is a subtle interplay between the teacher and the student, between the students and other students, between the teacher and other teachers within the Sangha, that creates something very, very special that almost feels like it's alive, that there's a living, breathing tradition. So sometimes when we talk about the lineage, we talk about it like a museum piece, you know, like it's a set thing that exists in some kind of a, you know, lockbox in a sacred vault or something like that. And we forget that the lineage is alive and that we ourselves are the lineage. That if it's not for us and us doing the practice, those of you who are teachers, you teaching, but also us as students practicing, that we are the lineage, that it's not separate from us. It's not something that exists far away in some, you know, cordoned corner for only a few people to touch. When we do the practice, we are the living lineage. And depending on whether or not we practice, then this determines the health of the lineage and the health of the Sangha. So when we ask ourselves, what am I doing? What am I doing? What's my contribution? You know, what am I contributing? Am I showing up enough? You know, am I taking ownership of the community? What way am I contributing? And that's something to think about in regards to how we can honor the gift of the practice and how we can honor the grace and good fortune that our lives have led us to this moment where the practice is in our lives and we've said yes to the practice. That's the double grace. Many people come into contact with yoga these days. You know, it's everywhere. It's in like, I think I saw an ad for like some bank that had yoga in it. I was like, wow, you know, it's everywhere. You know, in some ways, wow. And then in other ways, not everybody who comes into contact with yoga says, I want to go to class. You know, some people come into contact with the teaching and then they decide, it's not for me. You know, I was just speaking to someone who, by grace and good fortune, in the early 1970s, well, for some of you, are like, it sounds like long ancient history. So I was speaking to someone who was in the early 1970s, had the grace and good fortune to meet Maharishi Mahesh Yogi at his university in Kentucky. So he had no desire to learn anything spiritual. And then as part of a group course, they had the grace and good fortune that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was visiting and had a contact. And so he taught some classes. And this man I was speaking with learned a meditation technique from Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and he's kept practicing it to this day, which I think is amazing. There are many people in the class that he said just started not to come and thought, what's this weird mantra thing that's taking over my class? You know, that's considered it optional. But he said yes, and he kept working with the technique. So we think about now, you know, how many people interact in some capacity with yoga. You see it online. We see it, someone else is doing it. We see someone walking down the street with the yoga mat. We see it on social media. It's in the culture. It's in advertisements. Yoga clothing exists everywhere. It's in some ways saturated out there. I don't know if at this point there are people who've never heard of yoga. I think that maybe there are people who haven't tried yoga, but at least perhaps in North America, perhaps in Europe, perhaps in very remote parts of the world. I don't know. I think everyone maybe has heard of yoga at this moment, which is amazing. And how many people practice based on how many people have heard of it? Not everyone. So we have to acknowledge that we have the double grace of having come into contact with the teaching, and something in our heart said yes, and we had the determination and the follow through to show up and do the practice. We must acknowledge that. That is grace and good fortune. We have the means to do the practice. Maybe someone says, I really want to try yoga, but they can't. Maybe they think, I can't do it. Maybe the internet got turned off and they cannot spare a moment of their time, and they don't know anybody that can show them a few poses, and they can't afford a yoga class and can't afford to even travel to where a teacher is. And so maybe they have the desire, but there's an obstacle. So we must acknowledge, oh, I have the grace and good fortune to be part of the Yoga Sangha, specifically the Ashtanga Yoga Sangha, that there are people practicing that are on this path together with me. So what am I doing to contribute to the Sangha? Some really simple ways that we can think about our contribution are making sure that we connect with our fellow practitioners, you know? Hey, how's it going? You know, like, I've been seeing you practice for the last week. You know, what's your name? Where are you from? Just the simple contact of acknowledging people. You know, for many, when I first started practicing, I knew people kind of by their practices. And it took me a while to kind of figure out that, oh, they have names also, you know? It's not like that guy who's trying to put his leg behind his head, that girl who can't get up in handstand, you know, that one who can't remember the series. It's, oh, they have names also, you know? And I think it's a really, really important part of the creation of Sangha is to introduce the human to human element of, you're my fellow practitioner. I honor and respect you. I see the work you put in. And the way that we can do that is just by acknowledging one another, speaking with one another. If we have time, inviting, you know, yoga friends to spend a little time together, go for coffee or juice or a walk, or just check in. Because where that's helpful is to have a yoga friend, to have someone you can talk to about the practice, means that when you start to feel like, oh, I don't want to practice today, you'll have someone you can send that text to, and then they'll say, why, what's up? Because if you say that to people that don't share your yoga sangha, you say to them, oh, I don't really feel like practicing. They're like, so don't practice. I was wondering why you were doing that anyway. I mean, come back in the bed, you know? And then it's important that we have some kind of an additional support for us. And then we can be that support to someone else, someone to share our highs and share our lows on the spiritual journey, with the idea and the understanding that no one else is responsible for our practice but us, and we benefit from the synergistic effect of the Sangha. Now, I've seen fluctuations that can happen in community. I've seen communities flourish, and then I've seen communities flounder over the 25 years or so that I've been in the yoga world. And I know how special it is when a large group of people come together that share passion for the practice. This is rare. This is something to be cherished, something to be honored, something to be respected, and placed in our hearts to kind of re-nourish ourselves in times when we may be feeling lost or confused, that there is a way for us to connect back into our Sangha. Some of us have to travel to connect into the Sangha. When I first started practicing, my Sangha, my community of like-minded practitioners was all the way in Mysore, India. And when I would come back, I was practicing in my parents' garage by myself. And I would back out one of their cars. and clean up the oil stain on the garage floor. I constantly was like, you have a leak in the car, you need to get this fixed, you know, basically so I can practice. But I mean, also for the car, but I was more interested in not practicing on the oil stain. I think they did get it fixed at some moment. And then there were all these distractions, you know what I mean? I tried to make my father, when he was alive, come out and help me. And he was so caring and compassionate towards me, but he would sometimes make comments like, sweetheart, are you sure that's good for you? Sweetheart, that seems a little extreme. And I'm like, yeah, it's Ashtanga yoga. Like, it's like extreme. Yes, I'm putting my legs behind my head. It's as extreme. Absolutely. But I'm fine. It's good for me. Oh, well, okay then. You know, sure you don't want to come in and have some lemonade? I'm like, no, just go back inside. You know, I tried to, so Supta Vajrasana is a pose in second series where everybody needs help. I tried to get my dad to help me. I put a stool there so he could like sit on the stool and try to hold my knees down. But I had to go inside and like get him and like, okay, dad, it's time to help me. And that's when he would be like, oh, you're going all the way back. Oh, goodness gracious, you know? And no, but he really supported the practice. I was so excited when I first started practicing. I did one lead class like we did today, and I had no idea how challenging it was. I just thought, this was amazing. And so I brought my dad, and then my dad after was like, you tried to kill me. So I brought him to the practice, and then the next day he called me and said, I thought I wasn't going to be able to walk or get out of bed, but I want you to know that all my arthritis pains are gone this morning. And I thought, great, do you want to come next Tuesday? You know, because I thought, great. If my pain was gone, I would do it again. And then he said, we'll see about that. So again, the grace and good fortune to interact with the teaching and then for you to say yes. All right. Yes. Let me make space for that. Let me do it again. Let me do it again. Wonderful. Let me do it again. So I would practice, you know, with the sporadic help from my father. And then I would go back to India. And when I went back to India, wow, I felt like, this is amazing. There's all these fellow Ashtangis. I'm not alone, you know, in my parents' garage with strange Florida bugs visiting my practice. And then there started to be a flock of peacocks that started to visit my practice, which sounds really nice, but then, you know, they're quite large birds also. And, you know, when they start getting too close, it starts to feel like, oh, okay, back up now. Like, you know, my mom feeds them. That's why they suddenly started. And I kind of look like my mom. I think they were like, oh, are you also going to feed us? I'm like, no, I'm going to jump back. Like, no, you need to evacuate yourself or, you know, and then anyhow, there's a lot of distractions at home is what I'm saying. And you go to India, I practice in the room. There's no peacocks in the shala. There's actually peacocks in India, lots of them, wonderfully. And, you know, they also have bugs, but they also not so often in the shala. And then you go in and there's this energy of everyone concentrating so deeply on their personal practice. And even if you feel unmotivated, if you just stand there, that energy pulls you deeper. I would do the same practice that I did at home. And to this day, I just spent 2 months with Chatterjee, which is Pratapi Joyce's grandson. So my first teacher's grandson, who is my teacher now. And there's this energy that you feel when you walk in the room that I leave feeling charged from. So the same practice that I do at home can take me an hour and a half, maybe. Hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes, hour and a half. In Mysore, when I'm with my Sangha, when I'm with my teacher, that same practice can easily be 2 hours, 15 minutes, even 2.5 hours. So I was sitting there this time thinking, what am I doing? Why is this taking so long? You know, should I try to expedite? What is going on? And I realize I'm just so focused that my breathing is deeper. I'm trying harder. I'm getting the energy to try a second time, a third time. I'm focusing. I'm not rushing anywhere. There's nothing to do after. There's not, you know, meetings and appointments and various things going on that we all do in our daily lives. There's only the practice. So taking time out to be with the Sangha in a dedicated way can be very, very impactful for the depth of your practice. It doesn't mean that the asanas themselves will be deeper, but the depth of your yoga will be deeper. And that's hard for many people to understand. Sometimes our asanas don't improve. Sometimes they look different year by year. And from the outside, it doesn't look like progress. But on the inside, our yoga is deepening. And in the atmosphere of a dedicated sangha, that internal, contemplative, introspective focus really heightens in a way that's hard to describe. And when that changes and that shifts, we can carry that back into our, you know, into our everyday life. We can carry that back as inspiration to continue the practice. So again, to think about what are ways that I contribute to the Sangha. How am I showing up? Am I making time to connect in with my community? Am I connecting, actually connecting with my community? Am I talking to people, you know? Am I playing a role in the community in some capacity? If we have energy and time, and sometimes in India, people have energy and time that we don't normally have when we're working, you know, full-time jobs and dedicating ourselves to that combination of life and practice, then some people organize kind of community events, which are really nice. Last time I was there, some students, including myself and Tim, we got together and organized a Christmas party, which was really nice. And then some people that were there over Christmas this year said, oh, no one organized a Christmas party this year. And they said they were very sad. And that only some people with kids, then they decorated a Christmas tree. But there wasn't a whole, you know, Sangha holiday party. And so they said, will you come next year for Christmas and make a party? And I said, well, I don't know about, I can't promise that. But if I'm there, I'll make some party. But I can't promise exactly then. So sometimes one of the pitfalls of the Sangha is that we put too much emphasis on the teacher. We wait for the teacher to organize everything. The teacher is teaching. Their responsibility is to teach, to show up, to be available, to be the transmitter of the teaching, and to be available as the teacher. Sometimes the teacher is available to do community activities, sometimes not. Shataji in Mysore, Patabi Joyce, very rarely, while they were in India, were available for group activities. Sometimes when Patabi Joyce was alive, he was teaching in his 80s from 3:30 in the morning to 2 p.m. If we think about it, that's a huge amount of time. No break except for a coffee break. So now we start to understand where the Ashtanga phrase came from about coffee. Anybody know the phrase? No coffee, no prana. So if we think about that again, oh, I need to teach Ashtanga yoga from 3:30 in the morning to 2 p.m., then you start thinking, all right, let's pass the coffee over. You know, I'm not a coffee drinker, but I think at some moment maybe I would be like, what do we have? You know, something, anything. I mean, I like chai better, but so sometimes it was actually on the tour. So Patabi Joyce and Chatterjee, now they'll come and teach in different locations. And then sometimes there would be some group activity. Like I remember we were in Copenhagen with Patabi Joyce, and then everybody went on a tour of Copenhagen all together. It was really funny to see all these Danish people who have lived in Denmark their entire lives go on a tour of Copenhagen. That was really nice, including my husband. He was like, all right, let's go on the tour of Copenhagen. But it's part of the community experience. So the reason that I'm sharing that is that we are all vital parts of the Sangha. And if we value it, then it's up to us to take care of it and to think of what type of ownership can I contribute? What type of ownership can I take so that I can contribute, whether I'm on the teacher's path, whether I'm on the student's path? How can I support? Sometimes one of the things that is really touching is how much devotion that we as students can bring to the practice. So sometimes there's, for example, in the Shala in Mysore, there's a group of students that will come and set up the altar space. And nobody specifically told them, you come tomorrow and set up the altar space. But a few students got together and thought, oh, maybe we could come together and set up the altar space. So then they arrive earlier than everyone else. And already we arrive at 3:30 in the morning. So they come at 3 to set up the altar space. And we think, a.m., okay, not p.m., And we were like, oh, 3 a.m., middle of the afternoon, of course. Whoa, no problem. No, 3 a.m., they're arriving to set up the altar space. And then, so that's how, so that's a big contribution. So that when the students walk in, they see, oh, the altar is all set up. And when Charaji comes in, the altar is prepared. So there's a certain devotional quality of that. Maybe we don't have time for that. Maybe we can just take ownership of some small things. Like, you know, just thinking about, oh, where am I going? You know, how am I in this space? Oh, I see someone that's never been here before. They don't know where to put the shoes. They don't know where the bathroom is. Let me help them. Oh, hey, you look new. Do you put the shoes over there and the bathrooms are over there? Just a helping hand, you know? Have you been here before? Oh, I practice here. Let me give you the lay of the land. We see that so often over the many years that we've been going to practice in Mysore. There's a look of someone who's never been to India before when they stand there, like the deer caught in headlights look, like, ah, oh, I have no idea where to go, where to put their bag, no idea even what to eat, no idea even how to get from one place to another. And actually, my husband is really, really great. He's a really, really wonderful, wonderful being about this. He somehow has like a radar for these people. And at some moment, there were so many people that arrived to India, and somehow he knew them from one place or another. But he took everyone around and said, this is what you do, this is where you eat, this is how you change your money, this is how you get around, this is how you register in the shala, this is how you do this. So that, and I think I came a month later, and then I called him the mayor that time because everybody was like, hey, Tim, good to see you. Thanks for showing me around. Hi. And I, at some moment, we were on the motorcycle and we couldn't drive down the street because everybody was saying hi to him. And I became a little like, Tim, put the helmet on and just drive. Okay. Like, no, we need to go home. You know what I mean? Like, I love everyone, but I also need to go home. And, you know, so we just think about again, where within our own limits, respecting our, you know, we don't want to overcommit ourselves and overextend ourselves, but just to think about how am I contributing? How do I take ownership of the community that's there? How do I contribute? And then think of ways that we can honor the lineage within us, right? With also the understanding that just by showing up and doing the practice, for some of us, that's enough. That can be enough, just showing up and doing the practice. Now, I think I've said this before, but I also think it's important to understand and to reiterate that in traditional yoga methodology, the success of the yoga practice is contingent on 4 quadrants of effort. 25% is the teacher's responsibility. 25% is the student's responsibility. 25% is the sangha. So it's recognized as a vital component to continue our journey. Does anyone, maybe you've heard me say this before, does anyone remember what the last 25% is? Anyone remember? Any guesses? Time. The passage of time. Yeah, which cannot be rushed. So sometimes I think of this like a fermentation process. I don't know if you ever tried to ferment something, but you can't really rush that. You know what I mean? So you can't really be like, okay, I'm going to make kombucha in 5 minutes, all right? You know, I think we can like pressure cook beans quickly now with like an Instapot or something like this, but we can't. If you want to make a really good wine, and like I really never made wine, but I generally know that it's more expensive when it's older. So the more time that it's taken to produce itself, also balsamic vinegar, anything that needs, anything that starts to say, you know, 25-year age or something, you're like, oh, it's a serious passage of time. And then we understand the value of it. So sometimes we get frustrated because we don't see the results fast, immediately. Sometimes we think, how long before I get recognized by my community? And some people get frustrated by that. Who am I? I'm no one. How long have you been there? Have you actually been a vital part of the community? Or have you been outside looking in? Because as soon as you contribute, no matter what asanas you're doing, no matter where you come from, what economic means you come from, as soon as you as a human being contribute in some capacity, then I feel that the sangha starts to embrace you, you know? And that's something I think many people don't get. They look from the outside and they're kind of waiting for a private personal invitation. Oh, you, because you're special, come in. No, you find your way to contribute. And then that contribution is its own statement of value. And then, you know, when we become part of that living lineage. So sometimes we confuse the living lineage with rules and dogma. Rules and dogma are not the living lineage. The living lineage is so precious and potent at the same time that it can never be put in a box of rules of do's and don'ts. Otherwise, it wouldn't be alive. It would be a box that is that museum piece that many people think the lineage is. And if we start to confuse a set of rules, always do this, never do that, always do this, never do that, then we end up trading something that's alive for something that's, you know, an archaeological piece, a museum piece. So it's important for us to consider as students, also as teachers, many of you are teaching, to consider how can I communicate what is the potency of the lineage without being dogmatic? How can I express the importance of respecting certain elements of tradition without being too rules oriented? What is the space for people to find their own way and at the same time be on the path? Patabi Joyce, I feel, was amazing at this. And in many ways, some people got frustrated with him because he would very rarely give any technique. You know, people would ask him, how do you jump back? He would go, oh, jump back, you. You know? And you were like, yeah, me, I want to do it. Yeah, you, do. You're like, yeah, I want to do. I don't do. Oh, don't do. Why? Yeah, I want to do. And it was just like this kind of like almost like a riddle game that you would end up playing. You're like, oh, okay, I guess I try. Yes, try. Yes, yes. That was helpful. Thank you. You know, and then in some ways, people got frustrated. Well, where should I put my foot? Should it be here or there? Oh, you here or there? You know, or should I grab my toe or should I not grab my toe? Can I do like this or can I do like, and then what was even more frustrating is sometimes he would tell one person, you do like this. And then everybody overheard and then they started doing like that. Oh, that's the way. This is the way. This is the path. And then he would yell at everyone, why are you all doing like that? And you're like, but you said to do like that. So this, but this, okay, what should I do? And then sometimes one person would be doing what from the outside looking in would be a very misaligned variation of an asana. You know, like you would look at it in conventional yoga terms and you would want to go and, you know, give adjust, like make the shoulders like this, put the line like this. And Patabi Joyce would be standing over that one student and going, good, good, good. And you're thinking, what is good? You know, but we don't know. Like, we don't know. Maybe so part of what goes on is the inner emotional experience of the practice. So have you ever had an asana where you were terrified of that asana and then suddenly you weren't, you know, suddenly you were okay. You could breathe in the pose. So who knows? Sometimes I've heard someone be shaking and trembling and then their breath calmed down and something changed. And so that's great. Good. So what if the alignment's a little off for right now? The nervous system calmed down. Amazing. Wonderful. Well, alignment we can fix another time, you know, it'll sort itself out. Or there's also the other thing that I found extremely interesting about having little instruction for the asanas in the early Ashtanga days, which is that everybody needs to find their own way. Not everybody and not every human being is going to benefit from the same technique. One person, they need to activate this muscle. The next person, they need to relax that muscle. One person, they need to lift the hips higher. The next person, they need to drop the hips. One person, this technique works for. And you, one technique works for you for a little while. Then something changes in our life. And the new technique works for us. So it's constantly changing. And by not saying the hips should be like this, then there's space to evolve where the hip should be. One student, their hip can be there. The next student, the hip can be there. So there's space for everyone to find their own way in the practice. And I always love that. And, you know, this is why I think in some ways, Patabi Joyce was extremely hard to pin down about where should this be? Because he would tell you for you that day, but he might change his mind and then 2 weeks later make you do something totally different, right? Many people will ask physically based asana questions. So one of the things that comes up with centering the yoga practice around physicality is the false equation of the work and the magic that happens in yoga with stretching. And while stretching, bending, lifting is part of asanas, the work that happens in yoga is not to be measured in how much we stretch, how much we lift, how much we work physically. That is a tool that is used that draws us in, but there's something else that happens that we're working. There's something more subtle, harder to define, that's happening when we do the practice. And as we continue to practice for many years, in fact, I can recommend to increase the subtlety of our practice so that we place less emphasis on asana achievement and more emphasis on the subtleties of the inner experience. And at the same time, within the sangha, within the community, we recognize, oh, this student, they're on the first 5 years of their practice. Let them be in love with asanas. You know, oh, this student, they're doing asanas for 10 years, they're still in love with asanas. Great. At some moment, this is why I think Ashtanga Yoga has so many series. We just keep giving asanas, 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 until the student says, please, no more asanas. I don't want any more asanas. Can I do some chanting or something? Can I do some meditation? Can I lie here, please? In fact, anything but asanas would be wonderful right now. And at that point, there's some opening. Oh, okay, there's some teaching we can talk about. Oh, there's something more subtle. Oh, we can talk about the philosophical components. We can hone the mind to different way of practicing asanas so we're not so overwhelmed. So there are many elements to the practice that the sangha can support us through. And we want to be welcoming to new students. We want to be welcoming to people that are brand new on the practice and really embrace their excitement just for Surya Namaskar, embrace their excitement for how do I get my arm around in, you know, this pose. And then we also, a healthy sangha will have the elders, the senior members of the community. And this is something in, Western culture, that the elders of our community are somehow not as respected in ways that in the sort of wisdom traditions of the East, that the elders of the community were respected as being kind of the repositories, the keepers of the knowledge. And another more indigenous traditions as well, right? But in our contemporary Western society, the elders of our society are kind of forgotten, and sort of brushed aside in some capacity. So when we step into the yoga world, our sangha needs to include and be inclusive of a healthy respect of the senior members of our community. Just someone that's been doing the practice for 20 years. You know, they don't need to show anything other than they show up over and over again for that long. They don't need to show that they can still do a handstand. They don't need to show that their backbend is like this. They've been a part of the community for that long. That in and of itself deserves our respect. When they speak, we listen. As simple as that. No matter if someone brand new can do all the asanas like a performance, they lift up, they jump back, they float in the air like they're on the way to Mars, doesn't matter. That elder member of our community, we listen to. We listen. Don't have to agree. We listen. Give them space, you know? And this is something that our yoga tradition, I think, can heal in particularly Western, North American, even European culture in some capacity. So again, where are we? Are we teachers? Are we students? Are we vital members of the Sangha? Do we need to wait for the passage of time? So that's another thing to think about, the seniors and the elders in our community. They've seen the passage of time and they've been subjected to the passage of time. Maybe they have fermented like a good kombucha, right? With a lot of bubbles. You know, sometimes you get the kombucha that's flat. It's a little like, you know, tastes like vinegar then. So we want something that has a flavor, that has a chemistry that's gone through it, a process that's gone through it. When Patabi Joyce used to say you were ready to teach, he was looking for you to have sat through some personal process. It was, and now the process of sort of being recognized as a teacher within the Ashtanga Sangha is more systematic. And in some ways that's really, in some ways that feels really good because there's a system that's clear and evident. Whereas before there was kind of an unknown element of just one day you would be told, now you can teach. And then there were some people that they hadn't gone through some process and they really wanted to teach, and then it was confusing. So at least now there's some systematic approach, but there's some element of mystery, I think, about when are you ready to teach, right? When am I, I want to contribute and I want to be a vital part of the Sangha. And to ask yourself, is my role to teach? Not everybody will answer yes to that. And still, they can play a vital role in the Sangha. There are people that need to support the teachers. There are people that need to support the teaching. There are people that need to support the Sangha. There are people that can contribute in other enthusiastic ways that not everybody needs to be a teacher. If everybody's a teacher, who's a student? You know? And then also, everybody's a yoga teacher, then this yoga sangha needs like accountants and lawyers and plumbers and handy people, you know, and fire people and all these sorts of other professions. We don't, and we apparently also need a lot of photographers and filmmakers and graphic designers and people that know how to work computers and tech people, all those sort of things. So we have to think about how can I contribute? I know that in the creation of any large scale event that supports the Sangha, that there are not only teachers, but so many other people that come on board, administrators, people that work behind the scenes and operations that give of themselves in ways that people will never know about. So you may have a gift like that, that will be recognized and validated within your own path. So think for yourself, you know, some of you are already teaching. So again, that mystical question of how do I know my Sangha needs me to teach? One of the things I always say is because they ask you, you know, if there are people that are in your Sangha and they come up to you and they say, hey, have you ever thought about teaching? You know, or even they ask, how do you do this? I want to learn to do that. And they ask you to teach. At that point, okay, there's a call. You can answer it. I have a friend of mine that her Sangha has been asking her to teach for a long time, but she's saying no because she has a full-time job and family commitments and other things just not available for it. And that's okay too. You know, we need it to be a meeting point. So again, we think about the student's journey, the teacher's journey, the Sangha's journey over the passage of time. And we constantly reflect on taking time to come back and check in so that we can replenish ourselves with the recognition again of the grace and good fortune, the double grace of having come into contact with this teaching and that we have said yes so that we continue that work because it's new every day. You know, we could say no tomorrow morning. You know, I mean, one day a week, you want to say no and stay in bed. That's also part of your practice for Ashtanga anyway. You can't do Ashtanga yoga 7 days a week. We need one rest day. You can do meditation every day, 3 times a day, but we cannot do asanas. That's part of our practice is one day of rest. So we can, but that choice of I'm back on the path every day, it's new. Every day we say yes. Every day we say yes. So it grows and accumulates. Mm-hmm. Good. This is what I wanted to talk about, and I've talked a lot, and now we don't have that many time for questions, but if anybody has any questions, please feel welcome. You can raise your hand, or if you're at home, you can maybe type something into the chat. I don't see any questions in the chat yet, but does anybody have a question here? I'll give you a moment to think. So true. Yeah, it's so true. Yeah, it's something we almost take for granted. And it's something, so the importance of the community of going, you know, out to lunch with one another, going for a walk with one another, or, you know, just taking the time to reach out. And sometimes, you know, some of you might be thinking, oh, no one's reached out to me. What about me? Well, then if no one's reached out to you, it's up to you to reach out to someone, right? Again, how are we contributing? You know, there was a point when I started You know, when I was nobody, when I first went to India for the, nobody knew who I was. There were senior members of the community. I was the lost deer in headlights, you know, and there were not very many people to show me around. There were 40 people the first time I went. Then at some moment, I realized that people don't talk to me anymore. And like I stand there, people don't talk to me anymore. And I realized that they're afraid of me. And that if I want to talk to people, I need to go and talk to people. You know, the people that look at me and then they look away. I'm like, oh, there's something wrong with me today? And at some moment I realized, oh, these somehow, maybe for whatever reason, that don't feel comfortable coming up and talking to me. So I started to feel like, okay, let me reach out. Like, let me try to make sure that I am available to be a member of the Sangha, you know, rather than just wondering why no one's talking to me, you know? That's interesting at some moment, you know? So some people do that with the when you're in the role of the teacher. So many people have this with Shetaji that they don't talk to him, you know? They're like, oh, I don't talk to him. Oh, you know, Pathabi Joyce also, don't talk to him. And he's a human being, you know? If you want him to feel calm, you want your teacher to feel calm. Also, like, talk as a human being and part of the Sangha. With respect, okay. But that's also part of it, you know? We make the assumption that everybody's good. But then we think for a moment, oh, maybe I should reach out. Oh, maybe I should build that bridge. Oh, maybe I should just check in with that member of the community. Mm-hmm. Did people type at home? I think I see some paragraphs. Who's been typing at home? Let's see. Do you know, will you read one of those paragraphs out for me, please?
So, the first question is, how can you be an active member in your sangha if it's online besides showing up?
Yeah, so the virtual sangha is something really powerful. I mean, everyone's joining online, so thanks for showing up and being a member of our virtual sangha. So the virtual sangha is interesting. So we can have virtual friends, and which means that there may be someone that you can start a chat with and you can start a remote friendship with, that they don't need to be in the same city as you are. And maybe you'll meet them at a community event in person someday, or maybe not. So to build kind of a virtual bridge. So meet people in the group chat when you're online together, and find ways to connect online as well. I think that's also an important thing that we kind of forget about. One of the things that was really powerful about like the live classes online is that some people actually make friends in the chat section. And then those friendships carry off of the class and into our everyday lives. So this is one way I think is important. Second thing to think about is that there are ways in the community virtually that we can support the Sangha, we can support the community. So for example, let's say that there's a teacher that's on that you only know from being online. You only know them from being online. Send them a message occasionally. Hey, I'm really connected with your teaching. Thanks so much for making that available. You have no idea how important it is for teachers that teach virtually to get a little bit of positive feedback back, because people send negative feedback very easily. And it's important, if you are a member of a virtual sangha, to support that sangha. If there's a community space that's holding the space, so how you if you're here on Om Stars together with us and you think we're doing something right, send a message and say like, hey, this really was awesome, thanks for creating it. Those little messages of support help influence the virtual sangha. And then show up the same way as we've done today. And if there are also, so sometimes I get messages from people that are very grateful and they say, I don't have a community nearby. So the virtual sangha is all I have. And that's very important to acknowledge and really feel. At some moment, I don't know when, but at some moment we've talked about creating sort of a meeting point for people that are part of our virtual community. And in fact, almost any time I teach, or people that are teachers that are Om Stars member teachers, there are fellow members that come and are a part of that community. And sometimes people meet, oh, I see you in the chat, and you know, or I see you in class. And that's a really big part of the virtual sangha as well. Yeah, maybe one more.
Yep. At this moment, I am recovering from multiple changes in my life, and I feel very frustrated that I cannot recover my heart practice. How do I handle this?
Yeah, I hear you. So Whenever we go through multiple changes in our lives, and those changes include injury, and those changes include the loss of the asana practice we once had, there is an inevitable period of mourning and an inevitable period of frustration that we will go through. Oh, I could once do this. Now I cannot. Oh, I once used to practice every day. And, you know, I had nothing to do but yoga. Now, because of life changes, I cannot. I have injured myself, so I cannot do this practice. Or now I have to have a full-time job. I do not have the ability to practice for 3 hours a day. So life changes. There should be an inevitable acknowledgement and even a mourning period. That says what once was, but now this is what is. So any practice constitutes practice. So we have to understand that the quality of our effort is what matters and opens the door into the sort of the yoga journey, right? So as long as we're attached and we haven't given ourselves the period of mourning, of grief and loss for what once was, we'll never kind of have closure of that past and we won't be able to work on what is. And many people just try to work on what is and they don't actually acknowledge a period of mourning and grief and letting go of what once was. And if we don't have that, this is how it used to be. And I'm going to mourn that. I'm going to acknowledge my sadness, my frustration, all of my attachments, all of that, how much I wish it could still be like that. And I'm going to put that in a box and let it go. Whatever you need to process that, however long time you need to go through that, you need to sit with that. And it's hard. It's not fun. I've gone through many periods of injury and life change and all sorts of things. You know, I think age is something that comes for all of us. And we have to go through periods. This is what once was. This is what is. And then once we go through our period of mourning and loss, then we can sort of sit with what is and we can take stock with an open heart and meet it compassionately and say, okay, well, so this is what is. This is the time I have. This is the body I have. These are the injuries I have. This is the pain I have. How can I make what I have work to the best of my capacity to do the practice I can do? You know, and so many students will quit at that moment because they're constantly looking back at what once was an understanding with kind of an understanding that they'll never get that back, but not going through the process of mourning, loss, and letting go. So I think grief is something that we don't talk about so often in our culture, but grief is a big part of being human. We grieve loss, you know, we grieve things and we grieve people and times and, you know, and if we don't allow ourselves to feel that sense of loss and sadness, then we won't ever arrive at what is. I talked to a lot of people that after Patabi Joyce passed away, they were overwhelmed with grief and loss and they kind of stopped practicing. And they felt like, well, it'll never be the same. He's gone. And I felt like, yes, absolutely. Let's keep practicing though. Because we can grieve the grief and the loss of, you know, of an individual or of a period of our lives doesn't mean that what we have now is worthless. To find the worthiness of what is, we necessarily have to go through a detachment and a letting go of the past, not an erasure. So that's different. So the idea of mourning is that we acknowledge the grief that we sit with and the imprint that it has had on us. So there's some change that period of our life has left within us and it's made us who we are. We understand that. And then we focus on what is with an open and compassionate heart. This is harder than just getting new asanas. This is the work of yoga, sitting with our pain, our suffering, our loss, letting it work through us, and then cultivating a new, fresh attitude to what is and rediscovering the joy of, you know, of what is in the present moment, not what we wish would be one day, not what we wish still was present from the past, but really the joy that's available to us and then, you know, in what is. And then again, we go back to Let me connect back with my Sangha. Maybe there's someone else who's gone through this. Maybe I can talk to someone who's gone through this same process. Maybe I'm not alone. Maybe someone else has gone through major life changes, maybe serious family changes, serious financial changes, serious health issues, health changes. Maybe someone else has gone through a debilitating injury and they're on the other side of it. So I can connect with them. So lean into your Sangha at that moment. Lean into your community of life. Like-minded practitioners. Talk to your teacher about what you're going through so you're not alone. This is another thing where sometimes people, members of the Sangha, will keep their sort of journeys of suffering to themselves. And I'm not in favor of that. I mean, you need a little private time, absolutely. But at some moment, inform your teacher. You know, inform your teacher. Hey, my life circumstances changed. My family situation has changed. Health has changed. Finances have changed. Everything has changed. And my body feels the change as well. Inform your teacher. Talk to your Sangha about it so you won't be alone in the journey. And of course, find the way to keep practicing whatever practice means for you. Okay? Good. Well, everyone, I think we're a little bit, now we're at the time. So I just want to thank everyone for being a part of the Sangha, for being a part of our community. Thank you each so much for being here, for giving me your time, for staying here with the talk. And I hope to see you all again really soon. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey there, it's Kino here. I just wanted to thank you for tuning in to my podcast. Your support and your time and your attention really mean a lot to me. If you're enjoying this podcast series, you can find the full-length videos on my online channel, Omstars. And that's at www.omstars.com. You can redeem a 14-day free trial and get access to our full library of over 3,000 classes and also practice yoga with me online. I'd also love to see you in class sometime, so you can find my full live in-person teaching schedule on my website, which is kinoyoga.com. And if you haven't checked out my books, I'd absolutely be honored if you'd check those out. You can find those available at any online bookseller. The Yoga Inspiration Podcast is designed to keep you inspired to get on the mat. And I hope you're leaving each episode with a little glimmer and spark of the spirit, which is the true heart of the yoga method. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be filled with love. Namaste.